This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, and I welcome the astronomer Ken Croswell, who's going to take us on a voyage, a long voyage, with two wonderful robots from the 20th century, Voyager 1 and Voyager 2. Voyager 1, of course, starred in the first Star Trek movie as an alien who needed to be tamed. Right now, however, we're dealing with Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 as explorers. Voyager 1 was launched September 1977. That is a long time ago for human beings, but not for Voyager. Voyager 2 was launched August of 1977. Ken, a very good evening to you. As I understand it, Voyager 2 had the shorter route for its missions to the large planets, Saturn and Jupiter and beyond. And Voyager 1 then caught up later. What was their initial mission, why they were launched in 1977? Good evening to you, Ken.
Good evening, John. Yes, the Voyager mission has been absolutely astonishing. It's, you know, if you were to pass some law saying you have to get rid of all, retroactively get rid of all the planetary missions that NASA has ever launched except one, I would choose the Voyager mission as the one I would keep. It went to so many new places. Anyway, in 1977, as you note, Voyager 2 was launched first, and then Voyager 1. Their mission was to explore the giant planets of our solar system, Jupiter and Saturn in particular, and then Voyager 2 was going to go on to Uranus and Neptune. The reason Voyager 2 was launched first was simply because it took a longer route. By the time the spacecraft arrived at their destinations, however, Voyager 1 had overtaken Voyager 2. So it was the first of the two spacecraft to go to Jupiter. That was in early 1979. Amazing discoveries there. We had great pictures of Jupiter and the Great Red Spot and the moons. The moons were really a surprise as to how interesting they were. Io is a moon that is almost exactly the same size as Earth's moon. I had thought it would be gray and cratered and boring. Instead, there were active volcanoes, erupting volcanoes on Io, several of them that Voyager photographed. And, of course, there's the moon Europa. That moon was also quite interesting. It took a little longer to appreciate why it was interesting, namely that there is an ocean of liquid water beneath the ice surface of that moon. And then the two spacecraft went on to Saturn, making many additional discoveries at Saturn, looking at intricacies in the rings. Titan, which is the biggest moon of Saturn, astonished people by having a nitrogen atmosphere. We had never seen a nitrogen atmosphere beyond the Earth. The Earth has a nitrogen atmosphere. 78% of our atmosphere is nitrogen, and most of the rest is oxygen. And I remember as a kid thinking, gee, isn't it kind of depressing that the two nearest planets to us, Venus and Mars, they both have carbon dioxide atmospheres? Who wants that? Well, Titan was the first object in the solar system besides the Earth to be found to have a nitrogen atmosphere. And it was Voyager that made that discovery. And then, as I mentioned, Voyager 2 went on to Uranus in 1986 and Neptune in 1989. Voyager 2 tripled the number of known moons around the planet Uranus, and it quadrupled the number of known moons around Neptune. Neptune's largest moon, which we've known about since shortly after Neptune was discovered, it got good pictures taken by the Voyager 2 spacecraft, and is a world that is rather similar to the planet Pluto. So these are the great accomplishments of Voyager 1 and Voyager 2. And the great thing is they've kept going and they're still working.
Right. We're going to follow them as they go past Pluto and into the Kuiper Belt and beyond. But I want to make certain I understand their success back in the planets. They were taking photographs. Were they also giving us metrics from other instruments, Ken? Were we getting the sort of information we now get for Cassini probes and other robots out there?
Oh, yes. There were a number of instruments that were obtaining data on the planets and the moon. So, for example, measuring the magnetic fields. There's an instrument on the Voyagers for that and various other instrumentation. But, of course, the photographs are fantastic, too. The photographs, they're not just fun to look at, but they tell us a lot about what's going on.
They were not the first to go past some of these large planets. That was Pioneer before. Did Pioneer not have as good a photo, a camera? Is that the distinction?
The instrumentation of Pioneer was more primitive, and yes, the cameras weren't as good. Pioneer 10 was the very first one to go to Jupiter, and the Pioneer 11 went to Jupiter and then to Saturn. It was the very first one to get to Saturn. But the Voyager photographs of both Jupiter and Saturn are way better than the Pioneer photographs.
Now we will press on, because Ken's new piece in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences of the United States of America involves, yes, the accomplishments in our solar system, but then there's been this understanding that the Voyagers were exceeding the solar system in some fashion to reach the outer limits. There's very careful language here. Where are they now, Ken? How far out are they from the sun, measuring in astronomical units?
One astronomical unit is the mean distance between the sun and the Earth. Neptune is about 30 astronomical units from the sun. Pluto, on average, is about 40, okay? For those, just to put these numbers into perspective, by the end of the year, Voyager 1 will be 155 astronomical units from the sun, or about five times farther than Neptune. And Voyager 2, by the end of the year, will be at 129 astronomical units, so a bit more than four times Neptune's distance. So these spacecraft are way far out, and they continue to transmit data. And the cool thing is they're in a whole new realm of space.
In other words, they're at the frontier, but the frontier is somewhat in the distant future for them traveling. And what is it that makes it possible for us to communicate? I noted one of them. Are they both driven by plutonium? Is that their battery system?
Well, they're heated by plutonium, and they transmit their data via radio waves.
I see.
Radio waves travel at the speed of light. And so right now it takes Voyager 1, which is the farther spacecraft, about 21 hours to transmit its data, simply because it takes, even at the speed of light, it takes 21 hours for Voyager for the radio signals to reach Earth from Voyager 1.
Now, there are mysteries here, and I want to frame the mysteries with some technical language that Ken introduces me to. Ken, what is the heliosphere, and what is the heliopause?
The heliosphere is the magnetic domain of the sun. Okay, so the sun emits a stream of charged particles in all directions called the solar wind, and that presses against the space between the stars, the what we call the interstellar medium, okay? And the boundary between the two, the edge of the heliosphere, is called the heliopause, just as the top of the troposphere is called the tropopause. Okay, so the heliopause is, you know, after Voyager encountered Neptune in 1989, the question was, okay, when will the Voyagers actually cross the heliopause? When will they reach interstellar space? And nobody knew. In fact, when the Voyagers were launched, some people thought that the heliopause, that is the edge of the heliosphere, might be as close as the planet Jupiter. Okay, well, it definitely wasn't as close as Jupiter or Saturn or Uranus or Neptune. And you know, estimates for the edge of the heliosphere kept going up as Voyager kept going farther out. And ultimately, it wasn't until 2012 that Voyager 1 actually crossed the heliopause and passed from the heliosphere into the interstellar medium. And then 6 years later, in 2018, Voyager 2 followed suit. So both of the spacecraft are now in a whole new domain called the interstellar medium. Now, I hasten to add, this does not mean that either of the spacecraft has left the solar system. They're still firmly within the solar system. There are something like a trillion icy bodies that orbit the sun far beyond the orbits of Neptune and Pluto. They probably go out to one or two light years altogether. So both of the Voyagers are still firmly within the solar system. The analogy that I make in my Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences article is that if you were at the center of the continental United States and you walk 3 miles west, you have, in a relative sense, gotten closer to the Pacific Ocean than either Voyager has gotten to the edge of our solar system.
The estimate that Ken provides in his article is that the edge, the end of the solar system is at between 63,000 and 126,000 astronomical units. In other words, Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 aren't anywhere near where we believe is the end. Is that correct, Ken?
That's absolutely correct. So there's still a lot of solar system for the two spacecraft to cover before they get out of our solar system. But they are in a new domain in the sense that they are in the interstellar medium. They have left the heliosphere behind, and they're in a new environment. And so it's very interesting to study the interstellar medium, because the interstellar medium is where new stars are born and new planets. It's also where stars deposit newly minted chemical elements when they die. And so astronomers would like to understand it better. And, of course, they can do so using telescopes on Earth
and experiments. And that's what we're going to turn to when we come back, because one astronomer who was proposing how big the heliopause was confronted what you'd have to say was doubt. Now, one of the things I learned from Ken is that the original team that launched the Voyagers is still on duty in some fashion. So what we're looking at here is a very large argument about the heliopause. And when we come back, how was that argument resolved so far? Ken Croswell, an astronomer, he's the author of The Lives of Stars, but importantly, this is about how big the solar system. This is CBSi in the World. I'm John Batchelor.